And today I want to look real briefly at what we do with the Old Testament, or what you do with the Old Testament in regard to issues of violence, of military. What do you do? Anybody?
Throw up my hands.
Okay.
Good one.
Between these three markers, we may make it, but I doubt it. Anybody else?
What was the question? I'm sorry.
What do we do with the Old Testament? I mean the Hebrew Bible, yes, thank you.
You recognize it in its context.
Okay.
Cultural context, is that what I want to say?
Okay. Mm-hmm. Which means, therefore, what?
Explain it away.
Rationalize
it.
Relationship to the overall story of the Hebrew Bible. That's what I was thinking, the same thing that Sandy said.
Okay.
I mean, the Hebrew story is, you know, one that is telling about God's, God's coming to earth, God's in action among the Hebrew people to do His will, to manifest His will to the nation. You can't lose context to the point that it's not some sort of mystical destiny that the Jews are busy about. This relationship with God out of some context that may seem to be human and unique, but the power is coming from another source. I don't know.
Therefore, therefore, what? What does the Old Testament Hebrew story of war and killing, in fact, you know, extermination of whole cities, including animals, children, women, what does that say to us today? I mean, taking it in its context, does that mean because their context is so different than ours that it says nothing, or what? Or that it's normative for us today? Or something in between?
You understood the politics of Jesus was that all those stories emphasize God's intervention and God's saving them, but it still doesn't take away the fact that the stories include armies and bloodshed and fighting and...
Okay. Some would argue that the Old Testament really consistently points out that it's God fighting for them. That if we're going to be consistent with the Old Testament, we would drastically reduce our military capabilities so that when we do enter into a war, it's obvious that it's God that's getting us the victory and not ourselves.
I suspect that may be the term of their own beliefs. In other words, not necessarily the way we should relate to God.
What should we do then?
Maybe ties in with the context that we have to approach God in our own way, not the way they did in the Old Testament.
Okay, so you wouldn't worry too much about the Old Testament as far as this issue. Is that what you're saying?
I would say it's historical context.
Okay, but which means, therefore, we don't need. We certainly wouldn't say that it's normative for us today.
It's important in as much as history is important. The fact that just that subject of war, violence.
Kathleen?
God is portrayed in metaphorically suffering throughout with his people. So, strong emphasis on that, I guess.
Okay, so don't forget to suffering God in the Old Testament.
Where is that? In the prophets.
But not in Judges, not in the conquest.
Just in certain, suffering certain passages in Isaiah, certainly not in Judges. Okay, I don't want to spend a ton of time on this. I was really hoping that someone would have about a 3-sentence concise statement that would solve all the problems that I've faced over the last 10 years as I've wrestled with this, but you've disappointed me once again, along with every other group I've ever talked about this. Do you remember this guy? Marcion, never heard of him?
Nope.
What did he do with the Old Testament? Anybody know?
I don't know.
He was an early theologian in the early Christian church, one of the more famous heretics. He threw out the Old Testament, most of Paul, kept Luke and kept Luke and Paul and threw out just about everything else. And so this is what he did with the Old Testament. He could not in any way reconcile what he saw as the Old Testament God of war with Jesus, this new God. So he just threw out. And most Old Testament professors nowadays will say that most American Christians are Marcionites. That is, we don't want to do anything with the Old Testament. We just throw it out. So that's one thing you can do with it. The early church largely allegorized the Old Testament and took all this stuff from Judges and all the wars and everything as allegories of what our spiritual warfare should be today, but did not see it as referring at all to actual use of military things. As I said the other day, that the early church for the first 3 centuries was with few exceptions, pacifist, to use an anachronistic term. Another way is to say that the writers of the Old Testament or the actors of the Old Testament misunderstood what God wanted. We have it recorded in the Old Testament that God wanted the people to come in and wipe out the whole cities, and that's really what the people wanted, and they just attributed it to God. But that wasn't really what God wanted. They misunderstood it. Either one. Okay, that's one way of looking at it. Another that Dan suggests, and he's not saying that this is right, he's saying this is a possibility, is that when the scriptures were written down, much, much later, the tales of the conquest, that the people at that time, the time of the writing, were having so much trouble with their neighbors that they wish they had gone and killed them all. And that they were understanding that, I guess God really was telling us that because we're having so darn much trouble with them now. We wish when we'd first come in that we had killed every last one of them. And so they put that back into God. So it's later writers saying this is what God wanted and we didn't do it and we should have. put that down. And another way, certainly, is that the Old Testament is still normative, and that and Jeremiah 48:10 that I think it was June pointed out the other day. Cursed is he who keeps back his sword from bloodshed. You know, the righteous use of military. Now, I won't ask to see how we want to vote on those options. A common one today is listed in that little book, The New Testament Basis of Peacemaking, that sees moral progression in the Bible. That as people have had longer and longer experience with God and interaction with God, we are more and more capable of attaining somewhat more what God wants. So back in early Old Testament times, polygamy is allowed, slavery is allowed, and God, you know, doesn't deal with those right away, but waits until we're more ready to deal with and works us along, and would throw war in that same category, that or use of military. By New Testament times, people should have caught on enough about what God's about to then give that up too. I have some discomfort with all of these. And finally, has something to do with several of these, but to say, I was going to say simply, it's not simply at all, but to say that Jesus in the New Testament is the unique revelation of God, the authoritative witness of what God is like, and Jesus said, love your enemies, bless those who persecute you. So that, and Jesus has come to fulfill the law, that in many parts of the Old Testament we do see the God of love, the God of forgiveness, God of grace, the God of all the nations, all the Gentiles as well as Jews, you know, in various portions of the Hebrew Bible, and that Jesus fulfills that, and that's, if we really want to know what God is about, we look at the life of Jesus. I guess that's the one I'm most comfortable with. I don't know if that makes me a Marcionite or what. Okay.
But that doesn't really look at the Old Testament for the Old Testament's sake. It looks at the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah. Well, I would say as a Christian, you don't look at the Old Testament apart from the New Testament.
Mm-hmm.
And but some people would take issue with that. Comments? Questions?
How did that idea differ from moral progression, though? That Jesus is finally the revelation?
Well, perhaps it doesn't. I guess it doesn't emphasize how slow the people were in the Old Testament. It's, you know, Jesus could have come at any point, I guess. You're saying that the people were sort of messed up in all these wars at the time, but always had this future hope that they'd get beyond that? What I don't want to do, which sometimes comes out, is to say that we've got entirely separate conceptions of God in Old and New Testament, because we don't. We do get a lot of the seeming God of war and judgment and vengeance in the Old Testament, but there are those passages, many passages of the forgiving God, the God of all people. And in the New Testament, you know, you get not just Jesus dandling the babies on his knee, but you get him cleansing the temple and calling the scribes and Pharisees whitewashed sepulchers, and in Revelation you get some mighty vivid pictures of judgment and civil disobedience, if you will. So.
War in the Old Testament was to bring about repentance. God fought for them. And he thought, he mainly threw out the people of the land because they were evil and did what was wicked in the sight of the Lord.
Okay.
And so he pushed them out to set up his nation, which would be a light for the Gentiles, which would be a symbol for all people, so that people could come to God, and that war was, it wasn't so much a punishment, but it was to bring about peace. It was to bring people back to God, because they were continuing in their ways of sin, and so they, it's what they, in some ways what they understood.
Mm-hmm. Could we, does that continue to be the case today? I mean, could we say that we were going to wage righteous war on pagan countries?
I think God can, but that's probably wouldn't happen. I wouldn't see it happen through the United States.
Okay.
Maybe against the United States.
Okay, good. I think there... Yeah, I'm glad that I pushed you on where you're going to with that, because I think there are a fair number of people. I mean, the whole idea of, you know, President Reagan saying the evil empire, calling the Soviet Union the evil empire,
well, there's
makes...
There's certain validity in that also.
There is. But to say that, he also went on to say that, essentially, that it was the center of all evil, and, you know, and it seemed, it made me real nervous, like we're going to be the righteous ones to punish them, and... I think we have some beams in our own eyes, and certainly as I look at President Reagan, I have some beams in my eye as well. Okay. I wish this weren't on tape. I keep... 18 seconds of erasing there, right? Okay, I want to move quickly on here. Looking at civil disobedience. Holy mackerel. I'd rather discuss this, but I'm going to just write some things down and review them quickly from the reading assignments, and then we'll go on to do some discussing. In Dan's little book, what's it called?
By Faith Alone.
By Faith Alone. I can always remember Luther Looks at the Bomb, the subtitle. I can never remember the title. He talks about the idolatry of the arms race. And what are the characteristics of an idolatrous system? There are two main ones, and then he adds a third one.
It provides salvation.
Okay, all right. Promises salvation. What's the other one? The other main one?
Sacrifices.
Okay, demands immense sacrifice. And then do you recall the third one that he adds sort of at the end, just a little bit of a throwaway? Has a defined enemy.
Okay.
And he lists a couple of idolatrous, actually he lists three idolatrous systems in the past.
Nazi.
Okay.
Every in the 18th and 19th centuries. Jim Jones, people.
Okay, right.
He also mentions the apartheid system as our present example.
Okay. And his ultimate statement at the end of this section was, "We believe in the power of violence." And I'm not going to spend much time on this, but I think this is, and again, you know, you don't have to agree with me or Dan or anybody else, but I'm really convinced that idolatry is what we're talking about in regard to the arms race. And that when we get into discussions of the arms race, that as Christians, I mentioned this before, we stick to that which we have some expertise, or at least beliefs about, to stick with the Christian aspect of looking at the arms race, rather than try to argue statistics and things like that so much. Okay. Biblical examples of civil disobedience.
Jesus healing on the Sabbath as
well. Okay. Jesus on the Sabbath. Shoot them out. There's a bunch of them in that Sojourner's article, and just... Okay. Apostles continued teaching, despite being told not to. Okay, Moses, his birth being hidden there, and then leading people out of, certainly the Exodus. The form, you know, as Dan talked about all the time, the event of the Old Testament, the event that formed the Jews, at that time the Israelites, into a people, was the Exodus, a mass act of civil disobedience, if there ever was one. Okay, others?
Book of Esther.
Okay, Esther. We've got that first queen, whatever her name was, and we've got Esther, and probably the biggest one is Mordecai not bowing down or giving allegiance to Haman.
Daniel.
Book of Daniel. Holy cow. Where civil disobedience always came out that well. As in all these cases. Except for maybe the apostles and Jesus paid with their lives, but came out pretty well for these. Many of the prophets, Micaiah, Elijah, Jeremiah constantly, Paul. You know, what's interesting about Romans 13, people that argue about obedience to the state seem somehow to neglect that Paul was constantly in jail and eventually crucified. Does not sound like somebody who's always obeying the authorities. And an interesting, as I was rereading that one of the articles in Sojourners about civil disobedience, that the fact that Paul had to write this presumes that Christians were being disobedient all the time. If they were being really obedient, you'd never have to remind people to be obedient.
They were overdoing it.
Yeah, he wanted to make sure that that when the powers were acting as a terror to good, were acting in consonance with God's will, that people would then obey. Okay, American history. Some examples.
Thoreau, you think of?
Okay, Thoreau, not paying the war tax. Is that what you meant?
Yes, and also just advocating. So.
Okay. He was an interesting character. I don't know if I like him or not. Certainly interesting. Okay, women's suffrage. That's an area that I really should do some more reading in. There's some fascinating stories.
Underground Railroad.
Okay. Abolitionist movement and slavery. Certainly the whole birth of the nation. Boston Tea Party and the whole. Revolution. There's also I don't know if it's in the packet of reading or not, but I read once a fascinating article about a theory that the revolution would have that freedom and everything would have come much faster had the colonists not used violence, that or not used weapons at least, and something we never think of. We think of, well, you know, we'd still be English citizens if it hadn't been for that violent revolution. And it listed a whole bunch of nonviolent civil disobedient acts that had taken place early on.
It doesn't work too well in South Africa.
Not yet. Okay. Religious liberty. this really before the revolution. Conscientious objection to military service, rights of labor. At this point, I wasn't. I was just broadly civil disobedience, breaking the law. Yeah. Yes, that's right. Some. Some of the. Certainly, some of the abolitionist stuff. Some of the civil rights was intentionally violent. Let me skip ahead here. To discuss a couple of questions. Where does my personal sense of obedience Churchill once said, a preposition is a terrible thing to end a sentence with. And secondly, the whole issue of why not use legal protest in a democracy. Certainly in the, we look at those biblical examples, we weren't ever dealing with a democratic government for doing civil disobedience, and that's a big point. I don't know what I thought was going on at 9:38. My alarm just went off. Obedience to, well, this, in a general sense, it doesn't. I mean, you can answer that however you want. I mean, my sense of obedience is that comes largely from my father, who would do anything to avoid conflict, anything. And I have a lot of that in me that, you know, doesn't want to do that. You know. But this is the big question, I think, as far as the issue of civil disobedience today in regard to peacemaking, which is our topic at hand, which comes back to me all the time. When I, it's the area that has been the biggest source of conflict within the church in my personal experience. When I talk with people about what I do, or what my friends do, and you know, people say, I don't, you know, you can protest and carry signs and write your letters, but we do live in a democracy. And breaking the law, and taking the law in your own hands, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So, and you can, in small groups, you can argue, you know, for or against, and you don't have to say, or both at the same time, that yes, in fact, we should just use legal protest. I want to just read a couple of paragraphs in relation to that one from this that was in that folder on civil disobedience, disarmament, beyond illusions of freedom. I think it's certainly thought-provoking. I haven't decided how much I agree with it yet. Just got this from Audrey Riffenberg a couple weeks ago.
When we look at this written by Norman Solomon and Ada Sanchez, and it comes out of the Disarmament Program Fellowship of Reconciliation, or at least they have copies of it. When we look at the momentous issue of nuclear weapons, the critical question is not, what does the law allow us to do, nearly so much as it is, what difference does the law allow us to make? When it comes to nuclear weapons production and deployment, the laws and institutions of the land provide us with wide and varied freedom to be ineffective. This is the history of America's burgeoning nuclear arsenals. Perhaps more than any other society on earth, the United States supplies an array of activities within which concerned citizens are legally permitted, indeed encouraged, to occupy themselves. The results, often trumpeted as portentous, have remained cosmetic, while the U.S. military juggernaut, nuclear weaponry and all, rolls on. Representative democracy, a quote from foreign policy analyst Richard Falk, representative democracy on these issues is basically a delusion at this stage. While description of the perils of nuclear war have been bountiful and graphic in recent years, the responses are not close to being commensurate with the urgency of the moment. Another paragraph. Few of us are gullible enough to believe that we could survive a nuclear war with enough shovels, dug holes, horizontal doors, and piled dirt. But we remain willing to believe, against available evidence, that with enough lobbying, campaigning, and voting, we can stop the nuclear arms race if we work harder at doing what civics textbooks instruct for affecting government policy. And Reverend C.T. Vivian, who was on the personal staff of Martin Luther King Jr. at the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, he says, "We got political and economic change, the little we have gotten, because and only because of the nonviolent, direct action in the streets of America. We didn't get it because of the political process. We got it because we affected the political process." And then it makes the arguments that Vietnam protests and civil rights protests, the civil disobedience, is the only thing, or at least made changes much, much faster than had it gone through the political process, within the legal political process. Okay. So that's in relation to this, whether or not you agree with that. And okay. So do you know what we're going to be discussing here? These two questions. Where does your personal sense of obedience come from? Why don't each of you talk about that for just a couple minutes after thinking about it for a minute, and then discuss this issue. In a democracy, you know, is it legitimate to use civil disobedience? Okay. Let's do these five, and these five, and these four, okay? All right. why don't you take 1 minute sitting right here and thinking about these questions first, and so that, or a minute and a half, so that you can give your full attention then when other people are talking, and then we'll talk about it for like 15 minutes in small groups. Intrinsic to civil disobedience is the willingness to pay the penalty. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure those in those other issues people are willing to pay a penalty. Mm-hmm. I mean, any student in any classroom is free to act out, mm-hmm, and pays a penalty in most classrooms. And so I wouldn't shut the door. I mean, I would say that the door is there all the time. In October of 83, in the trespassing at the Honeywell plant, and that's the biggest defense contractor in Minnesota, been selected as an area of protest, a number of us, well, 577 of us, were arrested for trespassing, and we stood on the sidewalk and one at a time, respectfully and quietly, walked up there and were warned by an employee of Honeywell, and he went through the same spiel word for word 577 times. You are on Honeywell property, private property. If you do not leave immediately, you will be arrested. And then, you know, we stood there, and then one at a time were brought in, arrested, given a number, and hauled off. Many of the cases have been thrown out of court because we were not trespassing. We were still on the sidewalk, and we had not stepped on at the time. So the cases were thrown out of court, much to the discouragement of the protesters, because we weren't trying to get away with something. We were trying to say something. And there was that argument in our small group afterwards. People said, you know, we really weren't. You know, they didn't let us get on there, so we really weren't trespassing. That could be our defense in court. And then a number of us said, yeah, but that's not the kind of defense we want. You know, because we're there to make a point. We're not there to get away with something. I'm not a tax resister to avoid paying as much, you know, so I've got more money to spend on my fishing equipment, which is what I'd like. But I want to take just a few minutes here and relate some of my story. People last fall, I think, found that helpful. Dan talked quite a bit about his tax resistance, and there's going to be a session, I think, next week, I hope next week in the evening, specifically on tax resistance that Mary Wood had talked about. Back during, as I had mentioned, during my seminary time, when I was struggling with this issue and kind of came out in a position where I didn't feel I could participate in a military system anymore, it was real nice at that time, because what I thought was, well, I'm going to be a war tax resister, and I'm not going to participate with the draft anymore, but I was too old. I sent in my selective service registration, just shaking in my boots, because it's, you know, 5 years in jail, $10,000 fine. I said, I can't participate with this. Instead of, you know, burning my draft card, or as Dan says, boiling it. Just, you know, I wasn't much of a protester. I boiled my draft card. I mailed mine in, and with a letter saying I just can't participate. And about a week later, I got this letter back, and I could hardly, you know, stand to open it. And they said, we don't keep records on anyone over 21 years of age. I was 22 when I was too old to get in trouble with the system that way. And I also thought I'd be a tax resister, except I was still in school. I didn't make any money, taxes. So I thought, well, that was great. I could be moral without any cost whatsoever. But later, then, I did get a job and became a tax resister. And then, not till much, much later, till 83, like 8 years later, before I went to the point of trespassing at Honeywell. I think there's a sense of vocation, I think is the word that was used in the One Sojourner's article, that civil disobedience isn't for everybody. You know, sometimes people say, gee, I really admire your courage, and I just really laugh at that, because I don't feel courageous at all. I have a sense, what I call a primitive sense of judgment, that if we blow ourselves smithereens, I don't want to stand before God and say, well, hey, it was none of my business. I mean, I wrote letters to Congress and stuff, but yes, I did turn my back to my business and that thing. So I really feel that I've been more afraid of God than of people, though. I'm pretty afraid of what people think of me as well, of getting in trouble. And seeing the sense of vocation, I don't want to see it like those who do civil disobedience are somehow better and more righteous than other people. Because that's certainly not necessarily the case at all. You know, why in a democracy? For me, it's a sense of the urgency of the moment. I hadn't read this article until a couple weeks ago, but I'd had that sort of sense, I guess, without being able to articulate it, that I've written maybe 100 letters, and things didn't seem better. They're getting worse pretty fast, and drastic times demand drastic measures. And the sense, I think I may have mentioned here about Gandhi's sense of focusing on moral means, faithfulness, you know, rather than worrying about effectiveness. Especially when it comes to war taxes, you know, argument is always, well, eventually they get their money plus penalties and things like that. And I say, well, that's true, but I'm still going to make them work to get it. I'm going to, as much as I can, resist, say no to the idolatry, refuse to participate in what I see as the idolatry of the unfair. And I also see war tax resistance as the equivalent of conscientious objection to, you know, active military service. Because, you know, if I was too old at 22, certainly at 32, you know, they want my money a lot more than they want this senior old body, you know.